Remember your first kiss? A car accident? The loss of a loved one? Well, it turns out as soon as you recall that memory, you're changing it. Now, we tend to think of our brains as big hard drives with videos on them. That tape may be getting old and fuzzy, but it's essentially the same film. Now, scientists are saying that's not how memory works at all. They say new research indicates that people can erase painful memories or retain those memories, but wipe out the traumatic feelings they have in response to them. So a soldier suffering from PTSD, for instance, would still remember the battle, but would no longer be debilitated by that memory. John Lehrer wrote about memory and research on a so-called forgetting pill for Wired magazine. Jonah joins us now. And can you start with this idea we have of memory, that it's like a film in your brain? How does memory work?
Doesn't work at all like that. I think one of the most popular metaphors for memory now, we borrow from our computers, which is that our memories are like files on a hard drive. And so when you recall a file from your hard drive, the file itself doesn't change. It stays the same. It seems very simple. It seems very transparent. But that intuition, this feeling we have that our memories are accurate, is perhaps the biggest lie of all. Because what you discover when you look at how our memory actually works is that the very act of recalling a memory, summoning it to the surface of consciousness, changes the memory itself. So in a sense, the more you remember a memory, the less accurate it becomes. We incorporate new information. We leave out details. We make the story a little bit better, a little bit more emotional, a little bit more dramatic. And so our memories are always changing. It's a very constructive process. This is known as memory reconsolidation.
Tell us how people came to know this. I mean, came to find out that, for instance, there's protein, that's little building blocks that every time you recall a memory, they have to sort of help spackle and rebuild that memory.
The discovery, like so many wonderful discoveries in science, was largely accidental. It involved some scientists, Karim Nader and Joe Ledoux at NYU. This is back in the late 90s. Were giving rats a protein synthesis inhibitor. So this is the drug that prevents a particular part of your brain from creating new proteins. And scientists have known for a long time that you need to create new proteins in order to form a memory. And this makes some sense. You know, when you form a new memory, you are altering the wetware of the brain. You are creating a new circuit. And so that requires some cellular building. And that requires new proteins, which are the building blocks of, you know, of the brain, of the body. And so it made some sense that we needed to create new proteins whenever we made a new memory. But what they discovered, and this was largely by accident, is that when you give these protein synthesis inhibitors to a rat, when they were recalling a memory, you could erase the memory entirely. So you could train a rat to be very, very scared, for instance, of a particular sequence of lights or this one cage. And then if you would expose the rat to this stimulus, maybe the lights or the cage, and give them this amnesia cocktail, this drug that prevented them from forming new proteins, that fear memory vanished. They forgot completely about it. All of a sudden, they were no longer scared of the lights or the cage. They seemed like they'd never encountered this thing before in their life.
Okay, so a couple thoughts. First of all, poor rats, you know, were going through this as I was reading it. But the discovery seemed to be that it's not just in making the memory that you needed this protein, it's in recalling the memory that you needed the protein.
Exactly. That's perfectly said. The discovery was that the act of remembering a memory is very much like the act of creating a memory from scratch. So in a sense, every time we remember a memory, we are recreating it, which is why it still requires new proteins, because you are always tweaking the representation of that memory at the most fundamental level in the brain. The circuit of the memory itself is changing. The file is being dramatically tweaked.
Okay, so now we know that if you can repress those proteins, if you can inhibit them, you can make at least rats forget a memory. How do we go from there to forgetting a part of a memory, like recalling memory from your childhood, but not letting it have the power over you that it did previously?
Well, the reason scientists can just target particular parts of a memory has to do with the way memories are stored in the brain. You know, we think of the files as somehow being like these movies in which, you know, everything is just stored together. But our memories are actually, each part of the memory is filed in a discrete part of the brain. So the visual memory is filed in the visual cortex. You know, the memory of the smell is filed in the olfactory cortex. And the feelings, let's say the negative feeling of some traumatic memory, and maybe you're suffering from PTSD, so this is a very important thing in your life, the traumatic memory is going to be filed in a part of the brain called the amygdala, which is closely associated with lots of negative feelings and in part with the production of fear. And so the hope is that we can develop drugs which just target these particular parts of the brain. So let's say you've got a traumatic memory. you know, maybe you don't want to get rid of the entire memory because, you know, that'd be erasing a signal part of your life. Maybe you just want to get rid of the trauma, this trauma which is really debilitating you, this trauma which keeps you from leading a normal life. The hope is that scientists can go in and just erase the memory in the part of the brain that manufactures these negative feelings. And they do this by taking advantage of memory reconsolidation. So they would ask you to recall the memory while administering this amnesia cocktail.
In fact, you have an example of this, a woman who had just terrible things happen to her in her life. Yeah. Tell us that story as you continue.
So this is the story of Lois, and her life sounds like the story of Job. I mean, it is a story of tragedy after tragedy. A child dies, her husband's abusive and alcoholic, and eventually, after the death of her child, she begins to suffer from PTSD and crippling depression. She becomes an alcoholic, and so she's desperate for help. So she goes to seek out the help of Alain Brunet, who's in Montreal, who's conducting one of these clinical trials, and he administers a drug. It's called a beta blocker. These drugs have been around for decades. They are typically used to treat high blood pressure. Some performers take them to treat performance anxiety. What they do is they suppress the emotional response in the body. So let's say you're getting scared. They keep your blood pressure from spiking too much so you don't get the bodily symptoms of fear. And so what he does is he has her recall all these traumatic memories, and she's got lots of traumatic memories, while administering this beta blocker, which suppresses her negative emotions.
But I have to say, as I'm reading this, she doesn't know this at first. And so he's having her sit there and say these over and over again. And as she says to you, she's thinking, God, what am I doing here? I don't want to remember these things. But we refer back to the idea that she's recalling those memories, so she's rebuilding
them. She's recreating them, but in this new emotional context, where before, every time she'd recreate these memories, she was in a sense reinforcing the trauma because she'd think these thoughts and she'd get so upset, and so that negative emotion would get embedded deeper and deeper into her brain. But now, when she's recalling these memories in this new emotional context while taking these drugs which suppress her emotional response, the trauma is slowly leached out of the past, and the trauma becomes less traumatic. And for Lois, this was life-changing. For Lois, this has allowed her for the first time in years to lead a normal life.
A lot of the things that we're learning about memory run counter to what we thought, how we recall memory, but also how we should talk about it. And the thinking had been in the last few decades that as soon as something terrible happened to you, you should immediately talk about it so that it doesn't get sealed over. The idea is that Americans in particular were so repressed for decades, you were told to keep a stiff upper lip and not talk about anything, and then it became a repressed thought that revealed itself later. The new thinking was, in the last couple of decades, the age of Oprah, go out and talk about it.
Yeah, this really goes back to ancient notions of catharsis, the idea that there is something therapeutic about catharsis by getting the negative memory out.
Joan Allaire's piece in Wired Magazine is called The Forgetting Pill. We're going to get to that, too. We asked on our Facebook page, if you could take a pill to forget a bad memory, would you? Randy Nord writes, are you kidding? If we don't experience the difficult and painful, we miss out on the poignancy of life. We learn nothing. Grace Gooding writes, eternal sunshine of the spotless mind, anyone? A reference to the movie in which the characters raced memory of each other. Join the conversation at facebook.com/hereandnowradio. And Jonah, let's go back a bit, because you were telling us about catharsis, you know, Oprah, talking about traumatic events, making us feel better. And that evolved into a therapy called critical incidence stress debriefing. Tell us more.
The idea is that it's very important to, as soon as possible, get them to talk about the trauma, get them to express their emotions, to prevent that negative memory from becoming solidified and eventually becoming PTSD. So that was the logic behind it. And it makes some intuitive sense, right? I think we do have these intuitive notions that catharsis is good. But the evidence in recent years on CISD, critical incident stress debriefing, has been that it's often counterproductive, that people who go through CISD often experience higher rates of PTSD and often self-medicate, typically with alcohol. And I think one of the reasons CISD doesn't work, and, you know, or at least doesn't work as well as we think it should work, gets back to memory reconsolidation. When you recall a memory right after the incident, within 24 hours, your body is still flush with the trauma itself, with the terror, with all these very, very intense feelings. And so when you recall the memory right away and rehearse it, and the goal of CISD is to get you to relive these negative emotions as intensely as possible, I think one is, in a sense, reinforcing those negative emotions and making it tougher to change the memory later on. If we practice CISD, we should wait a couple weeks. We should let those those emotions subside.
Because as, you know, again, as your piece points out, the underlying thinking is you keep spackling, I keep using that word for the protein that works here, but you keep spackling more brick and mortar, if you will, onto this memory as you recall it. And if you're doing that spackling with the most intense emotions right in the moment, it's going to be an intense memory. If you wait a little while to talk about it, as your brain recalls it, that spackling that it has to do to recall it, to rebuild it, will be a little less intense.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, the larger point here is I think we have to be aware of and cognizant of the circumstances, the conditions, the moods, the emotions that surround the act of remembering a memory. Our memories are not static. They are always being informed by the present moment. So we have to think more about the present moment. If you ask someone in the midst of a trauma to describe the trauma they just experienced, they're going to solidify a particular kind of memory. It's going to be flush with those negative emotions. And so maybe it's better to wait until things have calmed down a little bit.
Well, and you also talk about a drug inhibiting something in the brain called PKM-zeta protein. What's that?
PKM-zeta seems to be particularly important for helping us maintain long-term memories, for helping them persist in the brain. And so the thinking is that if you can go in and knock out PKM-zeta, and they already have drugs which can do exactly that, and they've already demonstrated you can induce amnesia in rodents, that if you can go out and specifically erase this, you know, this one protein, then the long-term memory, maybe it's a memory you've carried around for years, will vanish. Poof, it will just be gone, simply because that circuit has been dismantled instantaneously.
Okay, so you've got, you know, the dismantling of circuits and the erasing of memories. You've got blocking certain aspects of memories, you know, having people talk about them while taking beta blockers and rebuilding a memory without the pain and the trauma that it had. So let's say someone who, you know, had a terrible accident or was at war wouldn't forget the war, but would have the feelings that came with that memory lessened. So here come the ethical questions. Isn't that what, you know, as debilitating as these can sometimes be, aren't these memories and events what make us who we are? Aren't there ethical questions about getting rid of them?
Absolutely. I mean, I think these treatments raise profound ethical questions. When you talk to some scientists, they say, who are we to say that here's someone with this traumatic event which is ruining their life? How can we not treat their pain? If it was physical pain, we'd have no ethical qualms about treating it. Why is mental pain different? I think it's further complicated by the fact that I think some of the first therapies that use PKM-zeta inhibitors, these drugs which can erase long-term memories, will actually be used to treat chronic bodily pain. So neuropathic pain involves chronic pain around injuries which have seemingly healed, and yet the nerves can't forget that pain response. Mm-hmm. And so the thinking is you can give them these amnesia cocktails just to the bodily nerves. So now, is that ethically dubious? Is mm-hmm. there something wrong with that? I think most people would say, of course not. Treat the physical pain.
Well, and there are also questions as to, you know, it's one thing to ease the trauma of watching comrades killed in war or having a child die. It's one thing to maybe ease that so that you can function. It's another thing if people start thinking, hey, you know, I broke up with somebody, pop that forget pill, you know,
Absolutely.
Forget about you. Or as one of the scientists says to you, his worst nightmare is that some evil dictator gets a hold of these pills.
Yeah, one can imagine all sorts of dystopian possibilities from that dictator putting these pills in the water. God forbid, we are many, many years away from that. That is still very much in the realm of science fiction. Two people taking these pills recreationally to get over heartbreak. But even there, you know, some scientists will argue, look, we're already in the business of trying to change our memories all the time. You know, we drown our sorrows in alcohol. We go to therapy for years and years at a time, trying to, in a sense, reconsolidate these memories, trying to reinterpret them in a better light. You know, I also have these intuitions and have, you know, talked to some ethicists and can sympathize with the President's Council on Bioethics, who in 2003 said there is something sacred about memory, that who we are is what we remember, and that when we start trying to curate our memories, trying to edit them like a playlist, you know, we're walking down a very slippery slope, that it's hard to imagine wisdom free from pain.
Joan Allaire, his fascinating article on the forgetting pill is in Wired magazine. We'll link it at herenow.org. Jonah, thanks so much.
Thank you so much for having me.